I care about this industry. I'm prepared to donate a lot of my time and energy in a thankless job where I don't benefit or profit in any way because I think it's important. I have my own issues with this organization, but I believe I can fix them, and I'd rather be part of the solution than, you know, continue to be part of the problem. And that resonated with most of the people I talked to. They said, yeah, that makes sense. You know, now, in retrospect, I probably wish I never joined the board. But once you sign up to do a job, I'm going to do it until it's done.
Hello, welcome to episode 32 of The Bitcoin Game. I'm Rob Mitchell. I don't usually comment on the news, but yesterday, January 14th, Bitcoin Core developer Mike Hearn announced he had quit Bitcoin, sold all his Bitcoin holdings, and described in some detail why he thinks Bitcoin is in a death spiral. As might be expected, mainstream news has jumped on this and the price of Bitcoin has dropped a bit. In his Medium article, Mike did some finger pointing. I acknowledge Mike has done a ton for Bitcoin, but when all you do is say how everyone else is wrong and you're right, perhaps your trumpeted tell-it-like-it-is attitude causes more friction than you realize. While there's no question Mike made some very relevant points about the issues that confront the Bitcoin network today, it doesn't change my mind about Bitcoin's strengths, and I don't believe it's going anywhere soon. That said, I'm no expert, and I assume we're in for a bumpy ride. But what else is new? Today's interview is with Brock Pierce, chairman of the board of the Bitcoin Foundation and a highly accomplished VC in digital currency. Brock got involved in digital token entrepreneurship at a very young age with a focus on gaming, an activity he excelled at. As he reached his mid-20s, Brock's companies were doing over $100 million in business. By the time Bitcoin was released, Brock had become a veteran in the business of digital currency. Brock was primed to recognize the innovation that Bitcoin introduced, and he quickly became one of the most involved venture capitalists in the Bitcoin space. The first half of this episode focuses on Brock's background. In the second half of my interview, I asked Brock to speak about the various aspects of the Bitcoin Foundation, which has faced its share of criticism in the past several years. In case you wonder what the intermittent background noises are, this interview took place at a Venice Beach restaurant. Just kind of had breakfast with Brock Pierce. I first actually met you. I don't know if you even remember meeting me, but I met you when you...
I do that. We were at, what's that Japanese bar?
Volcano?
Volcano, yeah. In the second floor of that back room area. We had a little standabout, kind of a, not a round table discussion, but a round circle.
Yeah, and I had attended a few Los Angeles Bitcoin meetups before that, and they'd all been really cool gatherings of, you know, some early adopters and newbies like me, and this was in 2013, and you came with Steve Beauregard and Michael Turpin and William Quigley, and, you know, at first you guys were just other people there, and then it became evident you guys, I'll just say, call you guys big shots. I don't know what to really call you, but
I'm definitely not big if you've seen me. Well, I'm definitely small.
Anyway, it was a whole new ball game, and you guys all talked, and I was fascinated with your background. So can you kind of go over some of your, you know, early entry into, I guess, what you call like digital assets? Or
I've been very entrepreneurial my entire life from a very young age, and that eventually led to getting into building tech businesses when the sort of dot-com boom or the internet first started taking off in the mid to late 90s. I also had grown up as a gamer, and so I played kind of everything and played Mortal Kombat kind of quasi-professionally, meaning tournaments for money and things of that nature, and I would do that in a lot of the, call it the early video game esports circuits.
So what year or how old were you?
And I was playing in paid entry tournaments for Mortal Kombat around 12.
Wow.
You know, in the Nintendo World Championship, you know, I was, you know, in the finals for Minnesota. I was the only, I think, person under the age of 18.
Does that just mean all you did was play games all day, or how'd you get so good?
I got good hand-eye coordination, and, you know, I'm a gamer.
Okay.
And so played a lot of games. But as a result of that, there was a company called Digital Addiction that made a game called Sanctum, which was a Magic the Gathering meets chess type of game, where you'd buy virtual packets of cards, you'd have your common, uncommon, and rare cards, you'd assemble a deck, and then you'd play against an opponent online, but you also had like a chess type board where you're moving your characters from as part of that. And having played Magic the Gathering and having bought and sold and traded, you know, cards of that nature, I contacted the game company and said, I'd like to buy your virtual packets of cards in bulk, much like they do in the analog world if I go to a baseball card shop or a comic book store. And I said, and I'd like to be able to sell singles, just again, like, you know, in the analog world. They go, that makes sense. Okay, no problem. So I started buying their virtual packets of cards in bulk, and I set up a single store, and the business was making maybe $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year. But it couldn't get any bigger because there were only 5,000 people that played the game. And so I kind of put it on hold at that point, the pursuing of sort of digital assets around gaming. But that's where my original insight came from, is that just because something was intangible didn't make it any less valuable. You know, it still has utility. It can still improve your social status amongst whatever peer group that you're trying to impress. So later, you know, fast forward another couple of years, there were the first massively multiplayer games were coming out, Meridian, you know, 59, Ultima Online, EverQuest.
Let me pause you real quick. So how old were you when you made this first bulk purchase and kind of really went?
I don't know. I was probably 18.
Okay.
I'd have to look up the
okay.
dates.
You weren't 12, that, though.
No. Because, okay. You didn't have online games like this yet.
Okay.
You know, I was buying and selling baseball cards and magic cards and things of that nature because I... would in some cases reverse engineer the algorithm of where they put the really valuable cards in the boxes. And, you know, I figured all that sort of stuff out by the time I was 10. I built a lot of what I'd call lemonade stand businesses as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
This was an attempt at actually building a legitimate business or a real business. But yeah, so one of the guys that worked with me said, hey, you should go check out Ultima Online. You know, there's these intangible assets that exist in these games, and there might be an opportunity to build another, you know, business like the one that you built. And so I went and did that. Then EverQuest came out, and I played around with that. And the lesson I, you know, was trying to having learned from my last business had failed, is that market timing is everything. And so I kind of was watching the market, looking at eBay, and seeing kind of transactions, you know, occurring, and waiting for sort of critical mass to form and massively multiplayer gaming to get big enough to be an interesting industry. So fast forward, call it another year or so, and. I set up a business to buy and sell the digital assets in online games, specifically EverQuest, which, you know, was quite a bit bigger as a market than Ultima Online. But those were the only two, call it, meaningful games out there. You had Microsoft had a game called that was from Turbine called Asheron's Call, and that was kind of all of the games, I think, at the time. Then you had Camelot that came out, or Dark Ages of Camelot. Then you had Final Fantasy XI, but... ended up going in, and if you were playing a game and you had too many digital assets, more gold, sword, shields, castles, whatever, than you needed, I would buy those from you. And if you were someone that, you know, didn't have the time to go accumulate or, you know, earn those things on your own, I would sell them to you. So, you know, essentially making a market between people that had too much time on their hands and those that had too little but had the expendable income, to compensate for it.
And how did both sides find you? How did they know of your existence and do business with you?
Well, again, back to value proposition. If you had more things than you needed and you needed money, you needed to pay rent, pay electricity, buy beer, or whatever it is that you were looking to do, you would find that. And there were already kind of markets for it, but on places like eBay and things where there was a high degree of fraud, you needed a trusted sort of intermediary or counterparty that you could rely on, because everybody's going, well, I want to deliver first. I want to get paid first before I deliver, or I want you to deliver the goods first before I pay. So in a peer-to-peer market, there was a high degree of fraud. And so you needed a trusted counterparty, which I guess will eventually lead into a good segue when we talk about Bitcoin. But I was the trusted sort of counterparty, that you would give me the goods first and I'd pay you, or you'd pay me first and I'd give you the goods, because you could rely on me and my brands to deliver.
So they basically, your people knew about your website or something?
Yeah, and so the main website, I operated, you know, call it 10 different brands in the space, but the main one was IGE.com, and we were by far the 800-pound gorilla of, call it, that business. And so built up a supply chain, because there were actually not enough people interested in selling the digital goods that they had to meet the market demand for all the buying that was there. So I ended up building a supply chain and teaching the Chinese that they could play games professionally and earn money. And so I ended up building a supply chain of about 400,000 people in China that would play games professionally to earn or mine digital currency that I would then sell into Western markets. And so I started doing that in the year, you know, call it 2000, 2001. I'm still in that business today. I still do about $1 billion a year of, call it, video game virtual currency, you know, exchanges. It's that business that eventually led me to Bitcoin. And, you know, more or less any sort of alternative sort of digital asset. And there's more than just video game currencies. Actually, the oldest of which, and what I consider to be the first digital sort of currencies, would be affinity program points or loyalty points, frequent flyer miles, American Express points, you know, et cetera. And those were, you know, designed to encourage customers to be loyal and come back and purchase from you again and again and again by offering them some sort of discount. In the case of video games, you know, that was part of the game mechanics. But the big difference between those and cryptocurrencies are that they belong to what you'd call a closed loop system versus an open loop system. You know, gift cards being another one where you're buying a prepaid, you know, sort of coupon or voucher that would allow you to spend. But all of those, call it currencies, can only be used inside of a, you know, a limited space. In the case of an Amex point, you can only use it with American Express. In the case of an American Airlines mile, you can only use it with American Airlines. There's a little sort of workaround similar to what Purse does with Amazon credits. And in the case of video games, your World of Warcraft gold was only good in World of Warcraft, unless you wanted to go through the friction of selling your World of Warcraft gold for U.S. dollars, and then you could convert those U.S. dollars into EverQuest Platinum and so on and so forth. But that's what led to it. And anytime anyone was building, you know, any sort of digital currency, for the most part, I ended up in conversations with them during their development. And so I'd seen a number of things prior to Bitcoin of people that were attempting to build, you know, digital currencies or, you know, alternative forms of money, which unfortunately had me a little biased. It's part of the reason it took me longer than it should have to really recognize and appreciate how novel and special Bitcoin was. I was a little bit biased having been around for too long and having seen too many things. A lot of the early adopters of Bitcoin came out of that same industry. Jesse Powell, the founder of Kraken, used to run another similar, smaller version of what I did with IGE. And there's probably about 30 or 40 of the, call it early adopter business people in the space that came out of that industry. Because naturally, if you were buying and selling virtual currency and online games, it was much easier to understand the value proposition of Bitcoin than it would be for, call it, the average Joe that had never heard of anything like this.
So what do you think the year was when you felt like you really were successful with this kind of a digital asset trading?
I was doing $100 million of revenue by 2004. You know, I was probably, I think I did maybe $50 million of revenue in 2003.
What were the difficulties back then of getting that business going?
Well, after the internet bubble burst in, call it, 2000, you know, at this point I was a, you know, washed up child actor who dropped out of college, you know, whose skills arguably were only as an internet entrepreneur, and at a time where no one in the world wanted to talk about internet businesses. I mean, there was no one in the world financing internet companies in 2001 and 2002. So the biggest challenge was there was no money. You couldn't raise capital. No matter how good your business was, PayPal was growing like a rocket ship, and no one in the world would finance it because basically the internet had burned everyone so badly in 1999 and 2000 that in spite of all of the data that says this internet thing is going to be around and it's going to matter, there was no one in the world that would invest in it. They were so burned because the idea of being associated with an internet investment was so toxic to your career that no one would do it. So that would have been the sort of biggest challenge. And
what did you do for funding?
Well, I had, I don't know, $150,000, maybe $250,000 left from the things I had done throughout my childhood and teenage years that I ended up dumping 100% of the money I had into building this business. And I remember running out of money as the revenues were ramping. I basically had completely run out of money, told the team, hey, I'm not going to be able to make payroll, but it looks like we're on track to hit profitability in the next 2 weeks. You know, bear with me, hang in there, we can do it. Dare to be great. And fortunately, I was right, and I hit profitability right as, you know, the plane is like, you know, I'm pulling back as hard as I can and lost sort of the wheels off the bottom of the plane, but I ended up getting in the air, and the business took off and ended up being, you know, incredibly profitable. I mean, we had pretty good margins.
So you owned 100% at that point?
I owned probably 80% of the business at that point. And then in January 2004, I merged with my number one competitor, which is another guy in Bitcoin. No one really sees him very often because he's not a social guy. He doesn't go out. But his name is Jonathan Yantas. And so Jonathan was the other big player in that space that I was in, virtual currency trading, et cetera, around games. And he was actually the larger player. He was number one, I was number two. And we merged our businesses in January 2004. And then as a result of that, then we had 80, 90% market share and margins. Well, I had been running the business with a counterintuitive model, which was buy high, sell low. Which if you stop and think about that is the opposite of what, you know, you normally, you know, buy low, sell high.
Yeah.
I had an inverse model. And my view was he was running with very high margins. I cared more about market share. I can always change my margins later. And so you know, I was running on a very thin margin, but I was growing rapidly. And so we ended up combining the two businesses, and that was where we did about, you know, call it $100 million in 2004. And at that point, we had no real competition, so the margins were, you know, 20% net margin. So we probably made about $20 million of EBITDA that month. I mean, that year.
Are these both U.S. companies?
Yeah, they're both in the U.S.
Does the Department of Justice care about monopolies in this kind of a segment? Or
no? Oh, no, I've dealt with antitrust issues in a number of instances. Too small of an industry to matter. Because you have to understand, how am I going to look at that industry? How am I going to look at that business? eBay was in my business as well. People could go buy and sell on eBay. You know, so you have to look at marketplaces as a whole. And, you know, it's called, you know, it's like Mark Twain's comments. There's lies, there's damned lies, and then there's statistics. You know, so it's really a matter of, can you produce enough statistics to support what it is that you're doing, and what is the size of the market? When you're talking about a market that's total size is $100 million, or $200 million, it's normally not something that is going to involve major antitrust issues. And you have to look at the game companies themselves. So, I mean, it wasn't much of one, but certainly paid lawyers to analyze that and take a look at it prior to, you know, finalizing that merger. And the lawyers signed off and said, no, there's no antitrust issues here.
So is this still the number one business in this tie-up?
Well, what ended up happening is, I taught the Chinese this business, and when I originally got into it, the Chinese, you know, most of them that I was working with didn't speak English, and they also didn't know how to get access to U.S. payment processing. So they had no way to sell directly. But over time, a lot of my Chinese sort of suppliers wanted to get into being direct sellers, and that's where my sort of margin compression started to rise in, call it 2006 and 2007. And so I made a very difficult sort of strategic decision, which was to cannibalize my entire business. And that was to go from being what looked like a retailer, where you'd come and you'd purchase products and, you know, I'd have, call it a 30% gross margin, because I'd buy something for $70 and I'd sell it for $100. But I'm also spending a lot of money on advertising and these sorts of things to make that work. But that business was under sort of margin sort of pressure as everyone's competing. And I said, well, if I can wipe out this entire industry by evolving into an exchange-based model to look more like an eBay or more like a NASDAQ. Mm-hmm. But it was going to completely undermine my existing business as it was. But I went ahead and did that. And so I bought a company called Player Auctions, a company called Item Bay, a company called Item Mania, and this is over 2004, 5, 6, 7. And I decided to push those businesses forward, and that's where most of that business is today. So I still do about $1 billion a year, but it's done through exchanges. And so on $1 billion of gross, we'll generate $100 million of revenue. You know, in my old business, I'd do $1 billion of gross. That would be $1 billion of revenue and $300 million of gross profit. So, I mean, the business model changed radically. But what happened in the process is I have 99% market share in the markets where I'm dominant. Because it's a thin margin business and no one can compete with it.
How did you deal with the fraud issues in a way where it made people want to come to you rather than eBay or something?
There wasn't any fraud. I took 100% of the risk. If you had a problem, I would pay for it.
Oh, with the exchange?
So I'm running an exchange. eBay is designed to be a one-size-fits-all. You know, anytime someone wants to go build an exchange for a niche market, you're going to design it to be bespoke. It's custom designed for an industry that I understood very well, and there are ways that you can deal with that, and that is that the exchange escrows the money.
So it wasn't peer-to-peer?
Yeah, the customer escrow. It is peer-to-peer, but we just provide a couple of minor services that eliminate those risks. And that is that we hold the money in escrow, product gets delivered, customer verifies, funds get released. And when there's a problem, that's when we get involved. And we'll do some sort of, call it dispute mediation. I mean, again, it's something that if you're eBay, you wouldn't go through the process of customizing the platform for every niche market. You know, they probably do in some instances, but they're a generic exchange versus, you know, an exchange that's tailored to a specific industry. You think about tickets would be another example. So if you want to buy tickets to a concert, you know, you'd think that, oh, well, eBay could be in that business, and they are because they went along and bought a StubHub. But, you know, the StubHubs of the world and those businesses that specialize specifically in tickets and tickets only got very good at dealing with the problems, you know, and the risks associated with the ticket market. You know, I was the equivalent of that for, call it, digital currency and digital goods.
Cool. So are there any other interesting businesses before you started getting into Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, I've done a number of things, but, you know, it's probably not as relevant.
Okay.
been focused on sort of the esports, which would be competitive gaming and sort of wagering on it. So if you're a Counter-Strike player or a Call of Duty player or a League of Legends player, the idea of creating mass market tournaments online where you can buy in with tournament entry fees, which is a wagering-based model around competitive games. In terms of payments, I was PayPal's largest merchant for years.
Wow.
I helped design their entire credit card processing division. It was actually Project IGE. They would accept credit cards directly without the customer signing up for PayPal. And I drove Alipay, almost all of their initial customers. I signed a contract with them, which gave me an exclusive on all digital assets.
So is that part of Alibaba? Or is that
yeah, that's the payments piece of it, which is massive. And they violated that contract with me, which is probably worth $1 billion if they hadn't. But I drove them all their initial customers. And they'd given me an exclusive, which they didn't abide by.
Well, I guess you want to start with your intro into Bitcoin. And
I mean, the early part of it is I got a call. Hey, what do you think of this Bitcoin thing? I just heard of it. I hadn't heard of Bitcoin yet. And as someone that's supposed to be a digital currency guru, I quickly said, hold on, I got it. Let me call you back. Come online. All right, what is this? Okay. You know, returned the call and did a little bit of research.
What year do you think this is?
Oh, this would have been early 2009. Anyone that heard of sort of things in this space would normally call me, and I just took a look at it. I didn't play around with it much. I ended up doing some mining in 2009. And then I just followed sort of Bitcoin for a couple of years. Again, one of the things I had learned early on in my life was market timing is everything. And I said, Bitcoin looks very interesting. This or something like it is the future. You know, the question is the future now or 25 years from now? And it wasn't until 2012 where I saw enough sort of critical mass forming, enough momentum building where I said, okay, I think the future is now. I need to drop everything I'm doing and jump in this space full time. And then I spent a few months kind of thinking about regulatory risks. You know, for those of us that were around in 2011, 12, or 13 and watching the space, there was a lot of perceived regulatory risk, which we don't really see today in a sort of amazing way. I didn't see governments embracing it to the degree they did, and I expected them to do a lot more to try and stop something like this. You know, and my concern, you know, call it in, you know, what's that TV show? We're in fashion right now. I guess orange is the new black.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think I'd look good in that color. And so I spent a good few months thinking about, okay, how visible do I want to be in this business? And so for, call it the first 6 months, I would have been, you know, kind of very much operating, you know, in a ninja sort of mode, primarily doing a lot of mining.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to figure out what are the opportunities? How is it that do I want to play it? Do I just buy Bitcoin or do I go, you know, actually try and build, you know, out some of the ecosystem and support building the bridges, the roads, and the tunnels that will ultimately allow it to be successful. And so that's how I ended up in Bitcoin and started out with a lot of mining and trying to figure out what are the regulatory risks, how do I mitigate it. And I remember sort of the moment where I decided to come out and be very, I mean, open about what it was that I was doing in the space is when I decided that the U.S. didn't matter. You know, I was operating with a very U.S. sort of mentality and going, well, let's just operate under the worst case scenario. Let's operate under the assumption that the U.S. government outlaws Bitcoin and says it's, you know, contraband. It's illegal to own it. And we can prosecute you if, you know, you do. And operating under that assumption, I said, what happens? I go, all right, well, I just stop operating in the U.S. I go, the world's a big place. And Bitcoin's value proposition is probably greater to people outside of the U.S. than it is in the U.S. And it was that moment where I had that sort of epiphany that said, it doesn't matter. Even if that were to happen, I still believe in this business and I want to be in it. And that's when I kind of said, okay, as long as I lawyer up and get good advice, I can be in this business and most likely not end up wearing orange. I don't like striped jumpsuits either.
So when was this and what did you do?
Well, then I started talking to, you know, potential entrepreneurs. My first thought was, should I build a company as CEO or should I go buy companies? And I led to a couple of things. One was starting to incubate and building businesses, and ended up starting a number of companies like GoCoin and a handful of others. And then also the other was on the acquisition side. I went and tried to buy Mt. Gox, originally using my old virtual currency business. I went to my board of directors and during one of the board meetings and I said, hey, you know, we've got 99% market share in the virtual currency trading business. You know, growth rates of that sector are slowing. You know, we need to figure out how to get continued growth. I said, I think that I found a market that's, call it, you know, parallel to us that I think has got lots of growth potential. And I said, I want to go buy this company called Mt. Gox. Have you heard of Bitcoin? My board is comprised of Goldman Sachs and Oak Investment Partners and some, and the Stevens family, which are my main partners in what I do today. But my entire board laughed at me. I mean, they're like, are you kidding?
So when was this?
This was, I guess, early 2013. Yeah, I got laughed at.
So that's when Gox was saying 20,000 new signups a day, I think, on their website. Was that? Do you think that was right?
I don't remember the... I probably still have some of my due diligence materials, but I don't remember if they were doing 20,000. I mean, they were the dominant exchange. I mean, Bitstamp at the time was live, but, you know, pretty small in comparison to Gox at the time. And their problems, they weren't having, you know, major withdrawal problems just yet. And I think a couple months later is when they had, you know, some of their money frozen here in the U.S.
Was that with the CoinLab thing? Was it CoinLab?
Well, the CoinLab deal... also happened, I think, shortly thereafter. It was Dawala, right?
Oh, where
it was the Dawala sort of account freeze. Wow, these are just details. Actually, in the world of Bitcoin, that was a long time ago.
I guess so.
But went and looked at buying the business. Then I told my board, I understand that you don't understand why I think this is an interesting opportunity. So what I'm going to do is send you a lot of information and things that you should read. And at our next board meeting, I'd like to reevaluate this. So I go back to the next board meeting. I said, hey, I'd like to buy Mt. Gox. And they laugh again. And I'm like, guys, it's okay to disagree with me, but you have to be informed. You haven't done the work. Go actually understand what it is that I'm talking about. And let's have a real conversation about this, which then led to us doing a deep dive and almost buying the business. So I spent a fair amount of time with Mark Karpeles then. We decided that from that business's perspective, it didn't make sense. But I went back and then I said, well, if we're not going to do it as a company, I'd like to do it personally. And so I went back and looked at buying Gox then and ended up focusing on a Chinese joint venture instead. So bought MtGox.cn and set up a management team and had lined up all the capital to go bring Mt. Gox into China because I thought that China would be a big market for it. And having done all of this work in the past, you know, I know my way around China. I ended up building a television channel in China and a bunch of other things over the years that, you know, we don't need to get into today. But and that eventually led to not getting comfortable with the fact that Mt. Gox itself, if you're in a partnership with them, if something were to happen with the parent company, if they were to lose a bunch of money or if their software were to fail, you know, my business would fail as a result of that. I had a major risk factor in that being that I was dependent upon Mark Karpeles and Mt. Gox. And I think I remember when I originally proposed buying Mt. Gox to my board, I said, well, there's this Bitcoin exchange. They've dominant exchange, very bad technology, very poor management team. But I'm like, we've got technology, we've got management, we can fix that. What we want is their market share. But I'm very, very glad I didn't buy it.
Sure.
I'm actually buying it, I probably could have fixed it. I'm happier that I didn't end up doing that joint venture because I undoubtedly would have failed as a result of the risk factor of Mt. Gox parent having a problem, which clearly they did.
I remember when there was the Bitropolis offices and, you know, I was down there for some kind of little events you had and when Jason King had his run. And I just remember random, you know, it looked like kids to me, but maybe they were developers, entrepreneurs who'd flown down to meet with you and talk about their projects and stuff. So you just seem kind of like the Bitcoin godfather already, kind of helping and giving advice and investing. So I was just really curious about all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so I helped, you know, start a number of businesses in the space. I've also tried to be very helpful in terms of any other entrepreneurs building things. I mean, I've been this way my whole life. You know, if someone comes to me and says, hey, you know, I'm working on something. Can I get your advice? Can I get your opinion? What should I do? You know, I try to be as available as I can to everyone. And I try to be as helpful as I can to everyone, even if someone's competing with me. You know, because I don't really view anything going on in this space as competitive. You know, sure, you can arguably say that, but we're not competing with each other. We as a community are, you know, a small industry. And, you know, in 20 years, when it becomes a zero-sum game, or 50 years, whatever that might be, okay, we're competing with each other. Right now, we're trying to compete with the world to be relevant. You know, we're still a very, very small industry, and most people have no idea what we are and why we should exist. You know, so my attitude is what's good for one is good for all of us. Rising tides raise all ships. And so I've always tried to be very helpful to everyone in the space. I try to attend a lot of sort of conferences. I try not to speak and run out the door. I try to be very, very accessible, and I've been that way since, you know, since I decided to publicly be in the space and call it the San Jose conference. Started, I don't know, 6-7 companies in the space that I've tried to be helpful with. I've done everything from mining to payment processing to, you know, selling to Bitcoin credit cards, debit cards, to building exchanges and so on and so forth. And what I realized is, if I knew where all the value would be created in this industry, if I thought that there's this is the one thing that matters most, I probably would have gone to build that one company as, you know, founder, CEO. But what kept happening is I'd say, well, there's all these sort of interesting opportunities and I don't know which is better. It's kind of like the internet in 1994. You're like, I know this internet thing is going to be big, but, you know, what's the biggest? And I couldn't figure it out. So I decided to play it broadly, you know, with an incubation model. And once I got up to, call it, you know, starting a company every quarter or every couple months, I realized I can't scale to the point that I can manage, you know, 10 or 20 businesses. So I said the only way to continue to scale and get broad exposure to the industry is to be an investor. And that's how I ended up evolving into setting up a venture capital fund, which is the main thing that I do today. I run a fund with my two partners, Bart and Brad Stevens. It's called Blockchain Capital. We're the first venture fund in the space. We're the most active investor in the ecosystem. We've got, I think, 42 portfolio companies today. Now we're on our second fund. We only invest in blockchain-based technology companies, and that I described today as kind of three buckets: Bitcoin companies, blockchain companies creating financial sort of services, SaaS-type products that they sell into financial institutions, and then alternative sort of use cases of blockchain technology, which is the area that we've been investing in the most lately. Stampery, for example, they're going after legal services on the blockchain and trying to eliminate the need for notaries, where I can drag and drop a file, a PDF, integrated into my email, whatever, where that file gets dragged and dropped, then it creates an immutable record on the blockchain where it's just time-stamped and hashed, and I know that document is what that document is and exactly when and where, you know, it was created. So we just financed that with Tim Draper, Adam Draper, and our firm, Small Financing. Great, great guys. And it's an area that I think is, again, interesting. When we talked about sort of 1.0 and 2.0 projects, I mean, most of our early investments would be in what I'd call Bitcoin projects, which is basic infrastructure. You know, we're investing in the bridges, the roads, the tunnels. I don't really want to invest in another exchange. There's already enough exchanges out there. I'd rather try and support the ones that exist today.
I can't remember if you said this while we were recording, but BTC China, you're a major investor, is that right?
No, I mean, we're an investor in BTC China. We're typically not a major investor in anything because our model is not to lead. We typically co-invest with top-tier VCs because, I mean, again, I don't want to get too deep into what a VC does, but if you're a venture capitalist that's leading financings, you know, you can only have about 6 deals, maybe 8 as a partner, maximum. We're 3 partners that run the firm. You know, we've got over 40 investments. The only way that we can scale to do that is by not being the main investor. You know, our goal is to work with Andreessen Horowitz or Khosla or, you know, any of the major firms, you know, RRE, First Round, et cetera, and say, let us co-invest with you as a domain expert that has a portfolio of resources that can be valuable to these companies. And so we'll add a disproportionate amount of value to the deal for the amount of capital that we're going to invest.
Today's magic word is foundation. FOUNDATION. Use the magic word to claim your share of this week's LTB Coin listener reward on letstalkbitcoin.com.
There's only so much time in the day. and I'd say I'm spread, you know, fairly thin, and I have still, you know, 5 or 6 other businesses that are not in this space that are operating today.
Oh, okay. You're a busy guy.
Well, my goal is trying to free up as much time as I possibly can because my main job is running Blockchain Capital, you know, and then the Bitcoin Foundation takes up some amount of time, and it's one of those thankless jobs. You know, you don't get paid, and it does require a lot of time.
Okay. Well, you brought up the Bitcoin Foundation, which when I first got into Bitcoin, it seemed pretty highly respected, doing core development and talk about lobbying, and now a lot of people are just dead set against it, I think. Can you say, you know, what you know about the history of the foundation and where it currently stands?
I mean, most of us, I think, know the history. It was the first sort of industry association, which is the right way to think about it. It has never governed or controlled Bitcoin. It's never, you know, said that it intends to try and run or manage or control Bitcoin. All it was trying to do is be a vehicle, a nonprofit, to collect money from the industry both individuals as well as companies that are interested in donating money to have it, those resources pooled to try and accomplish certain things. One of those was core development. You know, you had a lot of people building, you know, Bitcoin businesses, but you did need, you know, a few people that were dedicated and devoting all of their time to the core development of Bitcoin. And that was one of the things that the foundation did early on when, you know, there was no one else really doing that. You know, you had companies like BitPay that were, you know, paying Jeff Garzik's salary. And so it wasn't just the foundation. You had a few companies that would, you know, allow, you know, some members of the team to devote some or all of their time to core development. And that continues to be something important. I think there's not enough core development occurring today. But obviously, it's gotten better with time. You have more companies that are funded, and therefore more companies that can allow, you know, developers on the team to devote time and energy to core. Lobbying at the time was, I think, an interesting one, but it's one that I personally want to stay out of, because you have a lot of different constituents, you know, in the space, and lobbying is, I think, the one area where you're never going to get everyone to agree on what is the right position to take. And I'm glad that there are, you know, Perianne Boring and Coin Center exist. That are trying to do some of those things, and it's my personal view that the foundation should stay out of lobbying. We can have opinions about things, but I think from a regulatory perspective, less is more. And we're not, you know, in favor of encouraging regulation at this time. And that's just kind of our position, at least I think as a board today. You know, so the foundation was doing all these things early on. They ran into some troubles, obviously, you know, initially as a result of two of the early members having, you know, gotten in trouble in the case of Charlie Schrem getting indicted was a bit of a problem. The case of Mark Karpeles obviously hurt the industry and cost everyone a great deal of money. That led to those resignations, and that created, I think, some of the earliest issues with the foundation. You can take a look at any company, any organization, or any individual, and you can find reasons to pick them apart and complain about this or that. So those were the first big things. That's when I ended up joining the board, when the foundation was in a position to, you know, still do a lot of important things for the industry.
So when was it you joined the board?
I ran in 2014. I think it was the beginning of the year, because I was on the board officially at the Amsterdam conference was when I officially had joined the board, and I think that was in May.
So the Bitcoin Foundation basically put on that conference?
Yeah, that was a Bitcoin Foundation event. So they were holding all the original conferences that were big were hosted by the Bitcoin Foundation. So they were doing lots of things that no one else was prepared to do at the time. And my view is that when someone else wants to come along and do those things, let's let them. You know, when, you know, Coin Center and the Digital Chamber of Commerce got set up to go do lobbying, it's called, we don't need to compete with them. Our job is done. We did the initial work. We kind of paved the path, and now someone else has come in that wants to do it and focus on that one aspect. Great, not our responsibility anymore. You know, the role of the Bitcoin Foundation is to do the work that no one else was willing to do. You know, the work that no one else had the ability to profit from or didn't want to. And that was what the foundation has historically done and will likely continue to do. But, you know, when I joined the board, you know, I remember talking to, you know, a handful of friends who were like, why would you do that? You know, we don't like the foundation. I said, I have my own issues with the foundation, as we all do. But I'd rather be part of the solution than be part of the problem, because it's a lot easier to fix something than it is to rebuild something. And that's my opinion. Maybe I'm right. Maybe I'm wrong. But my view was, I care about this industry. I'm prepared to donate a lot of my time and energy in a thankless job where I don't benefit or profit in any way, because I think it's important. I have my own issues with this organization, but I believe I can fix them, and I'd rather be part of the solution than, you know, continue to be part of the problem. And that resonated with most of the people I talked to. They said, yeah, that makes sense. You know, now, in retrospect, I probably wish I never joined the board. But once you sign up to do a job, I'm going to do it until it's done. And I feel very good about where the foundation is today. I think we've got a fantastic board.
So the board is you and Bruce Fenton and Bobby Lee and...
The board today, or was, Elizabeth McCulley, Bobby Lee, Mickey Malta, and myself up until just recently. And the newest members of the board are Vinnie Lingham of Gift, who's at First Data.
Can I ask you about Vinnie a bit?
Yeah.
Just for a second? Sorry to interrupt you. I feel like he's given a few speeches. I've heard him talk a little bit where I felt like he was kind of down on Bitcoin and pessimistic about it.
I perceive that as honesty. I like that. You know, and I also like the fact that he's objective. Yes, we all want to beat the drum and, you know, drink the Kool-Aid. But I know I've had plenty of moments where I've got, you know, concerns and, you know, where I thought, you know, Bitcoin's on its way to the moon. And the reality is, I think it's going to be a long road. Most of us, if we're saying, are going to be on the little bit of this emotional roller coaster that our industry's been on. I mean, 2015 wasn't a good year. You know, it was very easy for any of us to get down. I think a lot of good work got done over 2015. And I think it weeded out a lot of, call it the fair weather Bitcoiners, you know, and I've said, you know, the people that are still in it, you know, call it late last year, are the ones that are truly devoted to the cause. You know, we're the true believers. You know, you saw very quickly when, you know, it was no longer in a hype cycle, you know, kind of, it was very easy for the people that did not truly believe in what this industry, you know, is and the opportunity that exists here, that are willing to do the work and go the distance. And most of those people are gone today.
And I didn't mean to throw you off track. You were going through the board members.
I think that Vinny's been honest. And yeah, he's, you know, been concerned because, rightly so, the growth rates weren't there. The use cases weren't there. We weren't seeing, you know, sort of the value propositions developing in the way that we thought. But I'm starting to see a lot of it there now. I'm excited about 2016. I think we're about to have a breakout year. You know, we won't know until we have the benefit of hindsight. But I, you know, going into this year, I feel good. My intuition says that 2016 is going to be a very, very big year for Bitcoin. I think it's going to be like 2013 all over again. But we'll see. But yeah, so Vinny Lingham's on the board. Michael Perklin, who started C4, great guy, standards body around kind of security and best practices to make sure that consumers are protected. And then Francis, sorry if I get your last name right, but Pouliot, another great guy. And so in these three instances, because we had two vacancies and we had one affiliate seat that was originally, you know, going to be on the board. The problem is the affiliate program never really got developed. And so there was not really an ability to easily add someone that ran an affiliate chapter. And through sort of various transitions, it just was kind of a bit of a busted program. But we made some interesting change. And that's largely because we were asking affiliates for some portion of their revenue. One of the recent votes that we just did has said that you can be an affiliate, an international chapter, you know, of the Bitcoin Foundation, and you keep all your money at this point, which I think is a good thing because it's going to allow that program to, I think, be more successful. Vinny had been the runner-up in the election that Bobby Lee and I got elected to, and Michael Perklin and Francis were the next two runner-ups, along with Bruce Fenton, who's not on the board, but he's the executive director. And so Bruce Fenton would have been next to have joined the board. He decided to abstain since he's already the executive director, and he put this proposal forward, and therefore Michael and Francis took the board seats. So these were all elected by the industry, and we felt that that was important to continue to operate from a place where we're representing the constituents of both the industry and individuals as best we possibly can. And I think the foundation's very well poised to do good things for the industry again this year, and we'll get judged by our actions.
I think a lot of people are just so concerned with the past lack of transparency combined with, you know, it seems like maybe mismanaged funds. You know, people will cite, you know, Mark Karpeles and Charlie Shrem.
By the way, I like Charlie.
Yeah.
I think he's a good guy. I just young and made some mistakes and didn't understand the risks that he was taking. But, you know, all my interactions with Charlie have been a pleasant one. I think he's a well-intended, you know, well-intentioned young man.
I feel like he's a bit of a hero to plenty of people, too.
And I share that view. So I want to make clear that I'm not lumping him in the Mark Karpeles category. Mark Karpeles hurt a lot of people and... I'm not a fan.
Sure. No, I guess I completely agree. I think
so
one
in Charlie's
is...
Charlie's defense, I want to make sure I add that comment.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm actually surprised sometimes when I hear people knock Charlie Shrem, because I think most people who'd be into Bitcoin would probably not think he did anything so terrible from what I know.
But. Yeah, he made a mistake and didn't realize the risk that he was taking, and unfortunately it caught up with him in this case. But...
Well, I feel like a lot of people who are into Bitcoin are completely into the type of transactions that he was probably fostering. So it's like...
But his advice to everyone, know the risks that you're taking. You know, if you're going to do something that, you know, is very much on the edge, try to get, you know, at least understand what you're doing and the risks associated with it and get some legal advice. You know, we are in an industry and I don't want to see anyone get hurt as a result of anything I ever say.
Do you think he was led on by, I guess... law enforcement who he felt like he was kind of working with or prosecuting?
I think just given bad advice. I would not have said, yeah, go meet with prosecutors and, you know, I mean, anything you say can and will be used against you in the court of law is, you know, remember those Miranda rights. I think he was well-intentioned. I think he did a lot of very important and good work for the industry and, you know, I've always liked him and I'm always available to chat with him and meet with him whenever he's back out here, which should be relatively soon.
But I guess that was just mostly a preamble to say it. I think it's mostly the financial and transparency things that have just so many people just so unhappy with.
But that was not the board that's there today.
Sure.
You know, and that's the one thing I would ask people is this is a fully elected board. It's None of the existing board, I think you could say, is responsible for any of the past mistakes made by the foundation. We're a bunch of guys that have a lot of better things to do with our time, and we can agree to disagree that we think that this organization still matters. We think that we can do good work with this organization, and we're devoting our time, energy, resources, you know, to do that. And I'd say, you know, give us an opportunity to demonstrate that we'll do some good work with this thing. You know, none of us are responsible. We are a fully elected board. We are completely transparent, you know, and, you know, we're devoting our time and energy, and we don't get paid for it. It is a thankless job, and we actually get a lot of hate for it. But as a board, we've voted to keep the organization running because we believe that it still matters. And it does when you get outside of our industry. And I think that, you know, the foundation shuttering would actually cause us a lot more harm. If you get all of your information from Reddit, or if you're an industry insider like we are, we go, oh yeah, whatever, the foundation. But to industry outsiders, you know, it's still a very relevant organization that has more members than anyone else out there. It still gets 90% of all the press inquiries. I don't think, to all the casual reporters around the world, I don't think we want to send the message that Bitcoin failed. In the same way that when Mt. Gox shut down, people said Bitcoin failed. When Mark Karpeles got arrested, they said Bitcoin CEO, you know, arrested. And I believe there's still work that can be done here that is going to be beneficial to us as a community and industry. And if you don't want to support it, that's fine. You don't need to be a part of it.
So you said 90% of the press inquiries.
I mean, tons and tons of press. So the Bitcoin Foundation is one of the oldest organizations at Bitcoin. And as a result of that, the media comes to us, you know, very, very often. I won't give the name of the organization, but for example, Bruce Fenton reached out to, call it, one of the biggest financial institutions in the world, just saying, hey, I'd like to come in and have a meeting and talk to you about Bitcoin. You know, the CEO responds saying, I'd love to meet with you. The foundation outside of our industry still is very, very relevant just because of its tenure. It's been around a long time. And most people outside of our industry are not even aware of any of the issues because they're not that in the weeds. And so it's our view that we can still do good things on behalf of the industry. And, you know, I think, you know, in the last month of last year, I think we did in 6 days more, we accomplished more than, you know, we had in the prior 6 months. And I would urge everyone to give us 6 months to demonstrate that we can do something with this organization that will benefit everyone. And if we don't, you know, my tenure's up the end of this year. I was elected to do something and to represent the constituents that voted for me. And it's my job to serve out my term and do the best I possibly can, you know, on their behalf. You know, my job is not to say, okay, I quit.
How do you feel about trying to, I don't know, do some kind of accounting and figure out just what did happen in the past?
The accounting's there. And all of the financials have been reported. We release the financials every month on a very timely manner. It's all there. Now, what happened is, in my opinion, and this is, again, pre my tenure.
Sure.
The foundation had received a lot of Bitcoin over time. And Bitcoin in 2013 appreciated a great deal. Everyone's going, oh my God, I'm rich. My Bitcoin's appreciating, you know, to the moon. We're going to be seeing $2,000 Bitcoin soon, $5,000 Bitcoin soon. I mean, anyone that was there remembers sort of the animal spirits that were out. And the foundation, like everybody else during that time period, was trying to scale up their business or, you know, scale up its, the things that it was capable of because it now had a lot of money all of a sudden. And it scaled up. And then Bitcoin came crashing back down. Now, the only mistake the organization maybe made, you know, that I consider to be, you know, a critical one, I get at the time, I wasn't there, but I do understand, hey, the price is rocketing, let's expand, let's throw bigger conferences, let's put this Amsterdam event together, which cost $1 million, which I think was actually a great service to the industry. It's the best conference I've ever been to, still to this day in the space. That was something the foundation did. And now what's sad is they spent $1 million and didn't make any profit. So that was just kind of bad execution and some probably poor decisions from an organization that didn't have a lot of experience in throwing events. But again, this is prior to my tenure. They scaled up, and I understand the thought process behind that. Everybody was doing the same thing. And then as the market was coming down, they didn't scale down fast enough. It took them a few months, and they ended up burning some cash. But I understand all of that. If I would have been there, I would have been more conservative and said, hey, we're a foundation. Let's, you know, preserve that capital as long as possible. Let's make sure we've got runway for 5 or 10 years. We're a nonprofit at the end of the day. We don't need to, you know, go big or go home. We're not a for-profit venture capital, you know, sort of funded business that's trying to be the biggest, best we can be. Our job is to kind of be there and do the things that no one else wants to do. And we can go slow. But, you know, I understand why those decisions were made, and I don't think that they were awful decisions.
My somewhat underinformed opinion on how much transparency there's been with the accounting was just, actually someone pointed out to me a fairly recent thread in the Foundation Forum with Bruce Fenton kind of saying, you know, it wasn't that clear and he didn't think...
Oh, it's all of the historic financials are published.
Really? So every Satoshi in and out is all...
I my understanding is it's all pretty well accounted for. There's only a couple of things where there was one of the original Avalons was given to us. I think Charlie Shrem was managing it, and we're not sure if the foundation ever got those coins or not. You know, there are a couple of minor things that are just difficult to answer the questions right now. I mean, actually, I've talked to one of the Bitcoin sort of analytics companies, and they said, hey, we'd be happy to, as a benefit to the industry, come in and do an audit on all the Bitcoin movements. And I forwarded that on to Bruce and said, yeah, you know, if you're happy to do that on a pro bono basis, we can't pay you for that work, but if you want to come in here and do that, we're all for it. We're all for transparency. Everyone on this board has always been for transparency. We're for a fully elected board. We've done all of the things that people complain about, though they're still unhappy with us, even though we do every single thing, you know, that people have asked for. And I think it's because a lot of them don't even realize we've done it all.
People kind of complaining that kind of blockchain technology isn't being used in the elections, and there's, you know, been some election.
No, we tried. We were during the last election, we were working with Joel Dietz and tried to use Swarm's product. But again, they were in a bit of a prototype state. And again, these things take time and resources. The intentions of everyone is, yes, do those things in the best way possible. Sometimes the product isn't there and ready to go. But I think that, you know, we're probably in a better position now than we were, you know, call it a year and a half ago.
And I guess there are just plenty of people who think the whole name of the Bitcoin Foundation is just too tarnished and it just needs to be let go and something new needs to start.
And everyone may be right. You know, I think that there's going to be a mixed opinion here. You know, we as a board decided that we think that the organization should exist. You know, we could always change the name of it. And there's, you know, all these sorts of things. And if someone has a really strong opinion and they want to be part of the solution instead of being part of the problem, we're generally all ears and we're happy to engage in anyone in a conversation. And if someone's got good opinions or good ideas, you know, and we have the ability to execute on them, we're going to. You know, none of us have all the answers. Yeah, you know, but we're all guys devoted to this industry. We're all doing what we can to try and make this industry succeed. Every decision we make isn't going to be the right decision. We're all just trying to help out. And if someone else wants to help us, please do. We're all ears.
Is the Bitcoin Foundation pretty much aligned with Bitcoin Core and other implementations are something you're kind of...
What are we talking about, like block size debate right now?
Well, I mean, that's part of it. Just say XT and there's, I guess, Bitcoin Unlimited.
I'm not supportive of any one thing. I'm just glad to see that people are trying to build different things and innovating and, you know, I just sit back.
I
just sit back and observe and let, you know, I'm not a core developer.
Is Gavin still somehow...
He's still the chief scientist, but, you know, his time is on MIT's salary at this point.
So it's just a figurative title at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, he's been with the organization for a long time and continues, you know, he still continues to be helpful. I mean, I'm a fan of Gavin's, and I know some people have been very critical of him. He's turned down many, many opportunities to join companies where he could have made, you know, could go make a lot of money. And instead of doing that, devotes his time to being a core developer in a very altruistic fashion, and I admire people that do that. Now, he's a guy that's devoted his time and energy to the benefit of the industry as a whole versus making himself rich. And I have a hard time being critical of someone that does that. I mean, he's devoted all of his time essentially to charity. You know, and he, of course, he's not always going to be right either.
So now I'm not saying I disagree, but to anyone volunteering time who maybe hold quite a bit of Bitcoin as an early adopter, you could say it is out of self-interest maybe to see Bitcoin succeed.
Yeah, but he could still go take a job with, you know, one of the, call it the leading Bitcoin companies, would have paid him very well and taken, you know, a nice piece of equity and still devoted his time to doing that. You know, he wanted to be in a position where he wasn't going to be influenced by anybody else's bias. And the foundation board has never influenced his bias. All we did was pay his salary. And Gavin, you know, was autonomous and able to do what he thought was best. And he wants to continue to be in a structure where no one is able to influence, you know, his opinions. And you can agree or disagree with whatever his thoughts are on the issue, and he's going to be wrong just like everybody else, you know, from time to time. But in general, I think he's a very, very thoughtful guy, and I think he's been dedicated to the benefit of all of us for a long time, and, you know, I'm a fan of Gavin's. And I'm, you know, there to support him as well as all the other core developers. I'm a big fan of Jeff Garzik. I'm a big fan of Gregory Maxwell. I'm a big fan of everyone that's devoting their time to core dev. And whatever position you take on any of these issues, you're always going to offend somebody.
Sure. Well, and it was pretty interesting with the just the block size debate, you know, how many intelligent, dedicated Bitcoiners had just such diametrically opposed opinions.
I think it's a good thing that conversation got kicked off. I like what Gavin and Mike Hearn did to some extent, which is they brought the issue to a head, you know, because it was something that was basically being neglected and no one was focusing on it. And it is important. I don't know the answer and I don't really even have an opinion, but I do know that this is something that needs to be addressed and the industry needed to be focused on it. And if nothing else, Gavin and Mike made this issue an area of interest and focus.
That's for sure.
And now you have a lot of very, very intelligent developers devoting a lot of time and energy to figuring out what is the best way to scale Bitcoin. And I have faith and confidence that we're going to come up with a good solution or solutions over time. Now, the only negative part of that is because this is a consensus sort of based democracy or democratic system, it's messy because everyone gets to see how the sausage gets made. But you know, once we get through this process, we're going to demonstrate how consensus-based systems work. Yes, it's messy because it's all done publicly, but you'll see that consensus works and that we as an industry will eventually get there. And you know, it's my hope that we get there sooner rather than later. But you know, I want to see it done right. You know, I'm okay with a lot of the sort of current proposals, which are let's make an interim small step. You know, I'm okay with baby steps. I'm okay with crawling before you walk, walk before you run. And I'm, you know, confident that the smartest people in the space are devoting their time to finding the right solution.
Are there any goals that you think the Bitcoin Foundation is working for in the immediate future?
The core of what we are is kind of an advocacy and education organization. We have a board meeting next week, and that is where, you know, we're going to put forward, call it our 2016 strategic plan that we as a board, you know, will vote on. I'd rather not get too much into my own personal opinions because I'm just one of a number of votes, and we'll hopefully have a plan, at least a straw man, that will be presentable when we release our minutes here over the next couple of weeks as to what we intend to do this year. And I encourage everyone to read that as soon as it's out. There's a bunch of smart people on this board that are devoted to this industry. If we can't figure out how to have some sort of material impact for the benefit of everyone, then we'll have failed. And I'll agree with everyone, you were right. You know, we should have thrown in the towel earlier.
Is there anything else you think is interesting or you'd like to talk about?
I'm just, again, excited about 2016. My intuition, which, you know, so far in life has served me pretty well, I feel really, really excited about 2016. 2015 was the year of the blockchain because Bitcoin had a very tough year and financial institutions have recognized that, you know, sort of distributed ledger technology and blockchains have lots of interesting applications. You know, and I'm feeling like this is going to be a very good year for Bitcoin, though I think it takes a long time. I don't think Bitcoin is going to see like 10x growth over the course of a year, like you can see with things like Facebook and WhatsApp and Snapchat. It's a difficult technology to wrap your arms around. I mean, for most people, you heard about Bitcoin the first time in, what, 2011?
I heard about it, yeah.
Yeah, and then you got in 2013.
Right.
So think about that as anyone in the business. We're all kind of technology people, whether you're an engineer or not, but we're all sort of technology savvy. We're all, you know, forward-thinking, early adopters. And for most of us, it took days, weeks, months, or years from when we heard about it to when we got in. Now think about that from an average consumer perspective. You know, just the learning curve of getting people to adopt the technology is very long.
And I honestly wonder if it's not really a user technology. It's a back-end technology.
And I think that's where most of our growth over the next 12 to 24 months is going to come from. It's where you don't even realize you're using it. It's in the back-end of products like Abra. And a lot of people are building products today where they don't tell you that you're using Bitcoin. We're just using it as a rail to move money across borders. Because that's one of the things that Bitcoin does today very well. It's one of the fastest, cheapest ways to send money across borders right now.
I really appreciate you taking the time.
It's my pleasure.
Is there any place you direct people to see more about what you're doing or just the foundation? Or
I mean, I'm out and about at, you know, many of the events. I was supposed to be at BTC Miami, but something has come up where I'm not going to be able to make it. But you can follow kind of the things that I tweet about on Twitter, at Brock Pierce. And I'm a big fan of Let's Talk Bitcoin. And when people come to me and they say, oh, what should I do? How do I go learn? I give them a few different answers in terms of the short stuff. And then I say, if you really want to go devote a lot of time, go listen to every Let's Talk Bitcoin podcast. And by the time you've heard them all, you'll probably know almost as much as I do, maybe more.
That's the primary way I learn.
As long as you listen. I mean, these podcasts are great. I'm a huge fan of everything you guys are doing. And it's a great resource to everyone that wants to learn.
Obviously, it's a network now, so yeah. I appreciate you saying you guys. I feel like, I can't take credit for all the stuff that Adam and Andreas and Stephanie and
you're sitting here right now adding content to this site. I mean,
honestly, it's just great because otherwise, how could I sit with you for however long this has been and get to ask every question I want to ask? Hopefully, I hit enough hard questions for some of the people angry at the foundation. I'm sure they're like,
well, it worked out. This ended up being a 2-hour sort of meeting and discussion when I only had an hour originally. Yeah. So I'm glad that worked out. I try to, again, always be available and accessible. And if ever, I run into anyone that's listening to the podcast here out and about, feel free to say hi. I'm always happy to answer your questions, and if you need help or want advice on the things that you're doing or building, let me know. And if your company's out there raising, looking to raise money because you want to build something in the space, we want to see everything out there, and feel free to reach out. You can email me at brock@blockchaincapital.com.
I hope you enjoyed episode 32 of The Bitcoin Game with guest Brock Pierce. You'll find all episodes of The Bitcoin Game at thebitcoingame.com. Find me on Twitter @TheBTCGame. See you next time.